Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Megan Cooper with Film Dayton. She'll tell us all about tonight's Oscar watch party. It's happening in downtown Dayton. And you'll hear from photographer Andy Snow. He's done some amazing work replicating camera shots of photographs of the 1913 Dayton flood. They're part of the Dayton Art Institute's 100-year anniversary exhibit that opened this weekend. Later in the program, this week's reinvention story. Up first, the weekend news. We're just about a week away from the deadline on a deal between President Obama and Congress to avoid sequestration, the automatic spending cuts that will go into effect March 1st. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, area businesses, and others related to the defense industry are bracing for furloughs that could impact the 13,000 civilian employees there. And there seems to be a growing sense of anxiety as to whether it's going to happen or not. This week, WYSO's news director, Emily McCord, spoke with Columbus Dispatch reporter based in Washington, Jessica Werman. She wondered if there was the same sense of urgency in Washington.
No. Actually, this past week, Congress has actually been out of town. Now, the president had an event on Tuesday where he was flanked by public safety officials talking about the impact on public safety. Congress is actually gone, though, for the President's Day holiday, so they're not returning until the week before this all shakes out, before this March 1st deadline. So if there is an end game here, I'm not really sure that I see it. And in fact, there are some folks who say, you know, this just kind of has to go into place. Nobody likes the way these cuts would go into place. But Republicans kind of believe that this is the only way they can get President Obama to get serious about cutting spending.
What are our local lawmakers, Speaker Boehner, Mike Turner, Senator Portman, what are they doing on this?
Well, let's break this down a little bit. First of all, for the most part, and I'm going to go into the exception in a bit, most of our lawmakers voted for the 2011 bill that basically put into play the course of action that's leading to these cuts. The exception is Mike Turner, who will remind you of this frequently, because he says that he saw this coming the entire time. Everyone, regardless of whether they voted for the bill, all of them will tell you that they don't like the way these cuts are, because they're across the board. They're sort of hacking with a machete away at these discretionary programs, and there's no thought to it. The best analogy I heard for this was I talked to a defense contractor in the Dayton area who said, this would be like you taking your budget and cutting 10% out of everything. You still had money to go out to dinner or to a movie, but you had 10% less to spend on your rent. And so as a result, all of the local lawmakers would say, no, this isn't an ideal way to do it. That said, there are some lawmakers who are willing to let this go through just because they really are concerned about our spending issues.
Give me a sense of how these cuts are going to feel if they go into effect.
I think that there's something to be said for the acute nature of these cuts. Now, it's not like we're all going to wake up on March 1st and the world will have ended and, you know, you'll try to go to your federal government office and it'll be closed. It's going to be kind of slow moving for a lot of people. Now, the exception would be areas like Dayton with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. For them, it's going to be a little bit sooner coming because the furloughs will happen. A lot of the folks that I've talked to are taking a 20% cut in pay through the end of the fiscal year, and I don't think it could be understated. You know, people live, in whether it's in Washington, D.C. or Ohio, there's a lot of folks who live paycheck to paycheck. A 20% cut in pay hurts. Wright-Patt is such a centerpiece of the region's economy. I mean, and not just because they've got some good jobs at Wright-Patt, but it's because there's a lot of other good jobs that are based on the good jobs at Wright-Patt. So it really is kind of, there's a potential for a domino effect. That's very destructive to a community, and for that to be endangered, it's nothing to cough about.
I've been speaking with Jessica Werman. She's based in Washington, reports for the Columbus Dispatch and the Dayton Daily News. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Any furloughs of civilian employees could have an impact on our next story. The state of Ohio wants a federal judge to dismiss the city of Riverside's lawsuit that seeks to tax civilian employees and contractors who work at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Back in 2007, the city of Riverside announced it would begin collecting taxes on those civilian employees who work on the portion of Wright-Patt that falls within Riverside city limits. That's Area B. Riverside's lawsuit argues that an unconstitutional provision in Ohio's municipal income tax law prevents them from collecting taxes from those employees. Riverside City Manager Brian Chudkowski says the law creates an arbitrary and unjustifiable tax exemption to those government employees and contractors.
And so we're asking the court to look at that argument and to determine whether or not these folks are being provided a unique privilege not provided to those who pay income tax where they work.
Workers at Wright-Patt's Area B would be subject to a 1.5% income tax if the city of Riverside wins its case. It won a lower court ruling several years ago, but then lost on appeal. The state's motion Tuesday argues that federal courts don't have jurisdiction over lawsuits filed against the state by its own citizens. Several members of Wilberforce University faculty, along with nearly 100 students, held a rally Tuesday morning to protest several ongoing issues with the school's administration. The faculty is asking Wilberforce President Patricia Hardaway to step down and for the Board of Trustees to disband. WISO's Wayne Baker reports.
Those were the chants of Wilberforce University students and several faculty members who held a protest inside the school's alumni multiplex. Richard Deering, president of the Wilberforce University Faculty Association, says President Hardaway should step down because of lack of student retention, limited or non-existent fundraising efforts, and little or no improvements to the academic program. Deering says that so far all of the issues have gone unresolved.
It so happens that today's convocation was the annual Founders Day convocation, and we have a senior member of the Board of Trustees who is the main speaker, a Dr. Jamie Coleman Williams. So this was really an effort to increase the visibility of the problems at the institution with the senior administration and with the Board of Trustees.
In a press conference Tuesday morning, President Hardaway said that all of the faculty's grievances concerning fiscal management has been submitted to the Ohio Attorney General's office, but the complaint was dismissed. She says that tough fiscal measures have been put in place in order to keep the school afloat. The mostly peaceful protest resulted in the arrest of adjunct professor David Evans. Richard Deering says the protest was effective because it successfully put all of the issues facing the university in the public's eye. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Antioch College says that a new conservation land easement will ensure that Glen Helen near Yellow Springs will be forever preserved and open to the public. It's the first of two phases designed to protect the popular recreational destination. WISO's licensee, Antioch University, was a co-grantor on the easement. Both the university and the college worked with the Trust for Public Land to complete the deal. Nick Budas with Antioch College is also director of the Glen Helen Ecology Institute. He says protecting the Glen has been a priority for decades.
This is a 90-year effort in the making that started back when Arthur Morgan realized that the Glen wasn't adequately protected from development and set on an effort to find a way to establish enduring legal protection for the Glen and at the same time try and build a base of financial support that would allow you to actually do something with the place once it was protected.
This is a first conservation easement, so there's more protections to come?
Well, that's right. Because of the funding source through the Ohio EPA, we needed to kind of do this in a little bit of a time sequence. The funding is in place to finalize the project, and we'll be able to do that by hopefully around mid-year.
How difficult a process was this? As you said, it's been a goal for a long time. So what are the things that have happened to make this a reality?
You know, I think what it took was a harmonic convergence of sorts of all of the people and all of the organizations that care about the Glen, recognizing that that there was a real threat for the Glen, should Antioch College or Antioch University no longer be able to be the owner and the holder of the Glen, and nobody wanted to see this place subdivided and developed, and so there was a willingness to kind of act on that sacred trust and to move forward with a level of protection that we'd never before been able to achieve.
You've been involved with the Glen for some time now. How is this for you personally?
Well, it's extraordinary. On my desk, I have a piece of pipe that's filled with calcium carbonate, and this is from an effort from the 1920s to protect the Glen, and they thought, you know, the best thing we could do at the time is to make the Glen a water source for the people of Yellow Springs, and so they ran a pipe from the spring into the town. That pipe completely filled with all of the sediment coming out of the Yellow Springs, so that effort didn't work. And over the succeeding 90 years, people have been trying to figure out how do we do this in a way that's enduring, that actually, you know, gives us some hope of really being able to plow our efforts back into land restoration and environmental education, to realize that we've succeeded where a lot of talented people fell short is incredibly gratifying.
Nick Budas with Antioch College and the Glen Helen Ecology Institute. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Funding for this $1.63 million easement included $1.2 million from the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, $200,000 from the Dayton Foundation, and more than $200,000 from the Clean Ohio Fund. The sales of the two easements will help support the land stewardship and environmental learning programs of the Glen Helen Ecology Institute. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Tonight is Oscar night in downtown Dayton. There's an annual party celebrating not only the event, but film production in the local community and in the state of Ohio. Megan Cooper is the executive director with Film Dayton. She says they've got a new tasty element to the fundraiser this year.
Dessert with Oscar, this is the first year that Film Dayton is doing this particular event. We're so excited about it. Local chefs have paired with us to have themed desserts after the Best Picture nominees.
Let's talk about details. Where and what time?
Sure. Well, it is tonight. Doors open at 7 p.m., and we want everyone to be able to turn their ballot in by 8 p.m. to watch all the action. It's at the venue on 3rd, which is on East 3rd Street in Dayton, Ohio.
Let's talk a little bit about putting this event together. How many hands involved?
It has been a great volunteer effort of the Film Dayton membership. But beyond that, we are just so grateful for the community and coming together. Like I said, it is a fundraiser for the nonprofit. So we've got fantastic chefs who are making the desserts for us. Chefs from Ovations, Baked, Scratch Event Catering, Jay Gumbo's at UD, the Sinclair Culinary Competition Team, and Carmen's Deli have all donated their take on desserts on the Best Picture nominees. But beyond that, something we are so excited about is the silent auction. We have got prizes, big and small, walk-on roles in Hollywood shows, great things like autographed pilot scripts from television shows like Revolution and The Mindy Project, and as well as fantastic dinners out locally, great events like, you know, seeing a show at the Victoria or going to a Dragons game. The whole community has really come together to say, hey, we want to support this and make it a fantastic evening.
What else is going on with Film Dayton? Any other events on the horizon, projects?
There sure are. Film Dayton is a celebration of film, which is what's great with the festival coming up August 23rd through the 25th, as well as this Oscar party. But we also work very closely to make sure that our cast and crew is as strong as they can be in attracting some of the films that are coming to Ohio this year. We've got a screenwriting workshop coming up March 9th and 10th, where an LA writer will be coming in and strengthening our writer skills with both TV and feature scripts. We've got a 48-hour boot camp coming up later this spring, where people are going to have a whole weekend to just dive in and do everything in making their own short film. And of course, the festival is the big event a lot of people know us for. The 5th annual festival, it's our 2013 Eichelberger Film Dayton Festival. First year to accept submissions. We've already got submissions from around the globe. This is an international film festival, all happening in Dayton this year.
The work that you're doing is very impressive, and we look forward to bigger and better things from Film Dayton. Reminders about the Oscar watch party tonight. Give us those times again.
Sure thing. Dessert with Oscar is tonight at 905 East 3rd Street. Doors open at 7 p.m., and the show gets going right around 8 o'clock. Come ready to bid on the silent auction, enjoy some fantastic desserts, play Oscar bingo, and just have a great time.
You've got plenty of room for folks. Do they need to get any tickets in advance or just show up?
We really encourage getting tickets in advance to make sure that you can get in there quickly and easily as possible. Ticketleap.filmdayton.com or learn all about it at filmdayton.com. But if you come to the door, we're going to try and get you in. It's $25 at the door.
Megan Cooper, Executive Director with Film Dayton, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Jerry.
Also coming up tonight, over 30 local musicians will recreate the band's 1976 Last Waltz concert as depicted in Martin Scorsese's film of the same name. It's happening at Gilly's in downtown Dayton. And earlier this week, Kaleidoscope host Juliet Fromholt spoke with the show's organizer, Jeff Opt. They began by talking about how the Last Waltz film inspired the local concert.
Love that film. As long as I've seen it, and just one of my favorites as far as rock and roll documentaries goes. But I'm always get frustrated sometimes with how Scorsese shot it, and I'm like, what else is happening on the stage? You know, because he does all these tight shots, and I love it. It's beautiful, and the music's great, and all that. But I always like, what else is going on? And you know, over the years, you talk to people, and they love that film too. And then over the last couple of years, I'm like, well, you know, Dayton has the talent. Boy, wouldn't it be fun to treat it like classical music? You know, like Mozart or Beethoven, it's rock and roll classical music, things that everyone should know, and perform it, you know, just as a concert kind of thing. So that's like the very basic idea in my head. Back in October, I floated the idea against, put it out to a few musician friends of mine just to see who was interested. And that started the very basics of it, got like our first six or seven people involved from that. And we had our first rehearsal in November, and it was a very organic growth process because I told them to invite anyone they thought would be interested in doing it. And it's kind of built from there. Like going in, I was hoping for maybe one or two horn players because I didn't know any horn players. And now we have an 8-piece horn section. And we have close to 30 people involved. And some of them I know very well. And some of them I've met through this. And I like the idea of what if propositions, like what happens if we throw this, you know, and just leaving it open to see what comes in. And we've just been blessed with amazing musicians coming in through the door that want to, I don't think I've turned anyone down that wanted to be involved in this. And they've all stepped up, and a lot of pushing people outside of their comfort zone sometimes, you know, or having people resonate right in their comfort zone, like Jimmy Rogers on organ is great. Just an archive of information about this. And I like mixing people together. You know, I think we have probably 3 or 4 generations of Dayton musicians all performing in this. You know, the youngest is a 17-year-old from Stivers, all the way to the era of Jimmy Rogers and Sharon Lane, and are all involved. So it's a real mixing of across different boundaries and music in Dayton. And I'm kind of like the Tom Sawyer role, where it was purely selfish on my part. You know, like, hey, I think this, let's throw a show. You know, anyone else want to do it? I don't have any money or anything like that. And threw it out there, and musicians jumped in and followed me in my dream. And here we are.
Now, you have kind of the core band, and then there's the horn section, and then there's all of the musicians kind of representing all of the different guests that came up with the band. You know, you had Bob Dylan and Van Morrison and all these different guest performers. How did you, as these organic rehearsal processes came underway, how did you then sort of figure out, this guy's going to do the Bob Dylan part, or this guy's going to be a part of the core band? Or did that also just sort of materialize organically?
That sort of developed organically. You know, like the first people that I put the word out to all came in, and most of them are in the core band. Trey Stone and Jimmy Rogers and Steve Phelps and Kyle Byram and Tim Pritchard and Larry Evans. They all kind of answered the call. And like Kyle was a person I was thinking for the Clapton role, but he's like, I'd really like to play this whole show. And I'm like, okay, you know, there's no reason we can't have two guitar players. We're not trying to be note perfect on what the movie was or anything, but we decided the best way to approach it is like the movie, with a core band that stays on through all those, because just for logistics of getting people on and off stage, it makes sense to have one group of people learn all 24 songs as opposed to having 10 bands up there trying to play it. There's some people that I had in mind for specific roles in my head that, you know, I'd love to hear Sharon Lane do Dr. John song and Paige Beller do Coyote. And I knew that she probably didn't know that song, but I'm like, she's got, that song's all about attitude and good vocals, and I bet Paige could pull it off. So she's one of those people that it was something unfamiliar to her. So she was willing to take the chance though and jump in. And I think she'll amaze people. And then other people approached me and said, like, Rich Reuter wanted to do the Clapton part. And I'm like, I truthfully had not heard him play. So I'm like, sure, let's try it and just see what it sounds like. And he jumped in and sounded great. Everyone liked him. And so that's how he ended up in the band.
And you mentioned, you know, that everybody is volunteering their time. And I don't want to omit the fact that this is a benefit show. All of the money raised for the show is going to the food bank. What was behind the decision to do that, to make this, you know, not just this great treat for the Miami Valley, but that is also doing a lot of good and giving back to a lot of people?
No matter how much we made, it wouldn't be enough to cover how much talent they had. We've done plenty of benefits for Sideshow, and the community has supported us and Yellow Cab and things like that, and as well as all the musicians in town. So I thought, well, let's make it a benefit show and give back something to Dayton, you know, musicians giving back, supporting their community that supports them. And then we started looking around for different charities, you know, that would be good and that no one could have any problem with. I don't know anyone that's opposed to feeding people. And the food bank this year especially is a little bit down on funding with the recession and all that. I've been following their post and things like that, and they're down about 20% this year. So I'm like, well, we can make a real difference, you know, with this show. The statistic they give is every dollar raised, they can make 8 meals. For every dollar raised. So people say, how much money do you want to give them? I'm like, well, it's not. I said, my goal is 10,000 meals. You know, I'm not even thinking in terms of money. So if we raise 10,000 meals in one night, that's a big dent.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeff Opt speaking with our own Juliet Fromholt about tonight's event at Jilly's in downtown Dayton. 30 musicians recreating the band's 1976 Last Waltz concert. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on WYSO.
And then this bit, the back side of this dormer, if you will, kind of visually resonates with the windows of the old NCR building that was torn down many, many years ago.
Yeah. Photographer Andy Snow has done some amazing work replicating camera shots of photographs of the 1913 Dayton flood. They're a part of the Dayton Art Institute's 100-year anniversary exhibit that opened this weekend. We caught up to him at the exhibit premiere at the DAI.
The Conservancy District commissioned me to make 60 photos from Pickwa to Hamilton to correspond to 60 historic photos from Pickwa to Hamilton. So we looked at hundreds, and we identified some, and that was an ongoing matrix of considerations, how to make a new picture that resonates with the old picture at that location, that helps tell the story, and further the idea that we're safe and that communities along the river have become more and more vibrant over the years, and we're not afraid to go to the river and do recreation in the river, like kayaking, canoeing, boat races like they have down in Hamilton at River Days, which is great fun.
How much time did you spend putting this together?
I started this the beginning of last May, and when the show comes down, it'll be a full year.
And what was the process, sifting through old photographs, deciding what you could do in reality?
Yeah, what we were able to do is we looked at literally hundreds. In some cases, if they were identified, and we could figure out where they were, and sometimes it was a matter of clues of old buildings and go to those places, or actually go to Google and look at Street View to see what might be there first, rather than go all the way to that spot, and then see what might be there, and then go there, scout, make a picture, look for a nice day, make a better picture, and then make a bunch of pictures. Because as I said, I made 5,000 files for this project. So the ultimate use of about 60 to 70 is just a little tiny piece of this wealth of imagery that I have.
And how much knowledge did you also have to sift through, and how much did you learn about this city?
I learned a tremendous amount about the whole region, specifically, of course, locations in Dayton, but also much, much more about Hamilton than I knew, Pickwa, Troy, West Carrollton, Franklin. I had never actually been across the river at Franklin in all these years, and there's beautiful homes over there that were heavily impacted by the Great Flood, and they've been restored to their former beauty, and it's a beautiful community. Middletown, same thing. Middletown was impacted heavily by the flood. In fact, the river channel was moved further west because Main Street of Middletown was really underwater when the water rose up in the channel and flooded the streets, all the way to where you see the picture on Central Avenue of the guy on the horse with a diminishing perspective behind him.
Were there any surprises along the way for you?
Oh, there were a lot of surprises. I had many, many moments of what I call serendipitous synchronicity in this particular picture that I just talked about in terms of Stewart Street at UD and the GE complex was one of them where you just know when you get there that the angels are singing and that you're supposed to be here and you're making a picture and it's in there somewhere and you'll know when you get to the computer that there's the one that says it all in a single frame.
What do you think visitors to the museum are going to take away from this project?
I hope they take away a deep sense of the history, a deep sense of what the difference was making a photo back then versus what it is to make a photo today, that there was a whole level of technique and craft in the old days. It's not the same as using your iPhone to make a photo. Nonetheless, you can still make great photos, but it takes time, it takes experience and expertise to really get a sense of how to make pictures that resonate with older pictures like these.
Andy Snow, photographer, thanks for speaking with us and good luck on the book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Reinvention Stories is a multimedia storytelling project that asks the question, how does a city of inventors reinvent itself? Sarah Buckingham has this week's profile.
Last summer, we met Karen Stevens walking her dog in South Park, where she lives. Her reinvention story is about coming home. As a young adult, she got into computer hacking. And about 10 years ago, she made her way to Northern California, thinking it was the place to be for someone like her with specialized skills.
I was living in Berkeley, worked a lot in San Francisco for law firms because I'm a computer forensics specialist. Say a husband is divorcing his wife. She wants to prove that he's cheating on her, where he thinks he's deleted all the emails from the person he's cheating on her with. I'm called in to go and find those deleted files. That's a computer forensic specialist. I never got over missing home. You know, California was great, but it was never home. It was like living an extended vacation with debt, piles and piles of debt. While California is absolutely gorgeous, it's very expensive. Home is a lot cheaper. You go, gee, do I pay the electric bill or do I go eat? You're like, why am I doing this? Why am I, you know, busting my hump to actually continue to live instead of going home, making the same amount of money, and living a halfway decent life instead of worrying all the time? That's all I did was worry all the time. You know, they say you never can go home again, and that's not true. You come home and reinvent yourself.
Stevens moved back to Dayton. She didn't want to work for those law firms anymore, so she set up her own business, Legal Data Recovery, and got the certification she needed to serve as an expert witness in court. Her business found a home at Tech Town, a place for entrepreneurs working with cutting-edge technologies like sensors and something called RFID, radio frequency identification. At Tech Town, she's part of the RFID Convergence Center, the world's only business incubator focused on that particular technology. Karen Stevens didn't just reinvent herself. She's inventing a new way to use RFID.
Basically, it's kind of a tracking system to prove that chain of evidence has not been broken, like the seal on the bag has not been tampered with. Dayton PD is actually going to be my guinea pigs, but I come also from a family of cops, so they kind of help out too when I have questions. Hey! It's been a long, arduous process, and I've had setbacks like everybody else, but I'm excited by this. Being at Tech Town helps me, because if I have a question on anything, the knowledge base that I can dip into at any time is unbelievable. I work with some of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life. The guy next to me, he's going to change the way you watch TV. I mean, just it's amazing the amount of intelligence that is in this incubator. Dayton promotes that. They foster it, and it's fantastic. Everybody knows, you know, the Wright brothers, but, I mean, I walk down my hallway, and there's a line of patents, and that's just the tip of the iceberg that's come from Dayton. It's amazing how many, and I think Dayton still has the heart of that. Never would have even thought to come up with this in California. Dayton will never lose that drive of technology, that drive to, oh, this is a really cool idea. I wonder how I can make it better. It seems to be in our blood.
For WYSO, I'm Sarah Buckingham.
To see a short film about Karen Stevens, go to WYSO.org. This reinvention story was produced by Steve Bognar, Julia Reichert, Kyle Wilkinson, and Sarah Buckingham. Reinvention Stories is brought to you by WYSO and Local Lore, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio Incorporated, in collaboration with ZEGA, with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, The Book Nook.